Frida and I dropped down to the ground, looking wildly into each other's eyes. When the women were some distance away, we went inside. Mr. Henry was in the kitchen, opening a bottle of pop. "Back already?" "Yes, sir." "Cream all gone?" His little teeth looked so kindly and helpless. Was that really our Mr. Henry with China's fingers? "We got candy instead." "You did, huh? Old sugar tooth Greta Garbo." He wiped the bottle sweat and turned it up to his lips, a gesture that made me uncomfortable. "Who were those women, Mr. Henry?" He choked on the pop and looked at Frida. "What'd she say?" "Those women," she repeated, "who just left. Who were they?" "Oh," he laughed, the grown-up getting ready to lie laugh. "A he-he we knew well. Those are some members of my Bible class. We read the scriptures together, and so they came today to read with me." "Oh," said Frida. I was looking at his house slippers to keep from seeing those kindly teeth frame a lie. He walked toward the stairs and then turned back to us. "Bet not mention it to your mother. She don't take to so much Bible study and don't like me having visitors, even if they're good Christians." "No, sir, Mr. Henry, we won't." He rapidly mounted the stairs. "Should we?" I asked. "Tell Mama?" Frida sighed. She had not even opened her powerhouse bar or her potato chips, and now she traced the letters on the candy wrappers with her fingers. Suddenly, she lifted her head and began to look all around the kitchen. "No, I guess not. No plates are out." "Plates? What are you talking about now? No plates are out. The Maginot line didn't eat out of one of Mama's plates. Besides, Mama would just fuss all day if we told her." We sat down and looked at the graham cracker anthills we had made. "We better cut off the turnips. They'll burn, and Mama will whip us," she said. "I know. But if we let them burn, we won't have to eat them." "Hey, what a lovely idea," I thought. "Which you want, a whipping and no turnips, or turnips and no whippings?" "I don't know. Maybe we could burn them just a little, so Mama and Daddy can eat them, but we can say we can't." "Okay." I made a volcano out of my anthill. "Frida, what? What did Woodrow do that you was gonna tell?" "Wet the bed. Mrs. Cain told Mama he won't quit. Oh, nasty." The sky was getting dark. I looked out of the window and saw snow falling. I poked my finger down into the mouth of my volcano, and it toppled, dispersing the golden grains into little swirls. The turnip pot crackled. See the cat? It goes meow, meow, come and play. Come play with Jane, the kitten will not play. Play, play, play. They come from Mobile, Aiken, from Newport News, from Marietta, from Meridian, and the sound of those places in their mouths make you think of love. When you ask them where they're from, they tilt their heads and say, "Mobile," and you think you've been kissed. They say, "Aiken," and you see a white butterfly glance off a fence with a torn wing. They say, "Nacogdoches," and you want to say, "Yes, I will." You don't know what these towns are like, but you love what happens to the air when they open their lips and let the names ease out. Meridian. The sound of it opens the windows of a room like the first four notes of a hymn. Few people can say the names of their hometowns with such sly affection. Perhaps they don't have hometowns, just places where they were born. But these girls soak up the juice of their hometowns, and it never leaves them. They are thin brown girls who have looked long at hollyhocks in the backyards of Meridian, Mobile, Aiken, and Baton Rouge. And like hollyhocks, they are narrow, tall, and still. Their roots are deep, their stalks are firm, and only the top blossom nods in the wind. They have the eyes of people who can tell what time it is by the color of the sky. Such girls live in quiet black neighborhoods where everybody is gainfully employed, where there are porch swings hanging from chains, where the grass is cut with a scythe, where rooster combs and sunflowers grow in the yards, and pots of bleeding heart, ivy, and mother-in-law tongue line the steps and window sills. Such girls have bought watermelon and snap beans from the fruit man's wagon. They have put in the window the cardboard sign that has a pound measure printed on each of three edges, 10 pounds, 25 pounds, 50 pounds, and no ice on the fourth. These particular brown girls from Mobile and Aiken are not like some of their sisters. They are not fretful, nervous, or shrill. They do not have lovely black necks that stretch as though against an invisible collar. Their eyes do not bite. These sugar brown Mobile girls move through the streets without a stir. They are as sweet and plain as butter cake, slim ankles, long, narrow feet. They wash themselves with orange-colored Lifebuoy soap, dust themselves with cashmere bouquet talc, clean their teeth with salt on a piece of rag, soften their skin with Jergens lotion. They smell like wood, newspapers, and vanilla. They straighten their hair with Dixie Peach and part it on the side. At night, they curl it in paper from brown bags, tie a print scarf around their heads, and sleep with hands folded across their stomachs. They do not drink, smoke, or swear, and they still call sex nookie. They sing second soprano in the choir, and although their voices are clear and steady, they are never picked to solo. They're in the second row, white blouses starched, blue skirts almost purple from ironing. They go to land-grant colleges, normal schools, and learn how to do the white man's work with refinement. Home economics to prepare his food. Teacher education to instruct black children in obedience. Music to soothe the weary master and entertain his blunted soul. Here, they learn the rest of the lesson begun in those soft houses with porch swings and pots of bleeding heart. How to behave. The careful development of thrift, patience, high morals, and good manners. In short, how to get rid of the funkiness, the dreadful funkiness of passion, the funkiness of nature, the funkiness of the wide range of human emotions. Wherever it erupts, this funk, they wipe it away. Where it crusts, they dissolve it. Wherever it drips, flowers, or clings, they find it and fight it till it dies. They fight this battle all the way to the grave. The laugh that is a little too loud, the enunciation a little too round, the gesture a little too generous. They hold their behind in for fear of a sway too free. When they wear lipstick, they never cover the entire mouth for fear of lips too thick, and they worry, worry, worry about the edges of their hair. They never seem to have boyfriends, but they always marry. Certain men watch them without seeming to, and know that if such a girl is in his house, he will sleep on sheets boiled white, hung out to dry on juniper bushes, and pressed flat with a heavy iron. There will be pretty paper flowers decorating the picture of his mother, a large Bible in the front room. They feel secure. They know their work clothes will be mended, washed, and ironed on Monday, that their Sunday shirts will billow on hangers from the door jamb, stiffly starched and white. They look at her hands and know what she will do with biscuit dough. They smell the coffee and the fried ham, see the white, smoky grits with a dollop of butter on top. Her hips assure them that she will bear children easily and painlessly, and they're right. What they do not know is that this plain brown girl will build her nest stick by stick, make it her own inviolable world, and stand guard over its every plant, weed, and doily, even against him. In silence will she return the lamp to where she put it in the first place, remove the dishes from the table as soon as the last bite is taken, wipe the doorknob after a greasy hand has touched it. A sidelong look will be enough to tell him to smoke on the back porch. Children will sense instantly that they cannot come into her yard to retrieve a ball. But the men do not know these things, nor do they know that she will give him her body sparingly and partially. He must enter her surreptitiously, lifting the hem of her nightgown only to her navel. He must rest his weight on his elbows when they make love, ostensibly to avoid hurting her breasts, but actually to keep her from having to touch or feel too much of him. While he moves inside her, she will wonder why they didn't put the necessary but private parts of the body in some more convenient place, like the armpit, for example, or the palm of the hand, some place one could get to easily and quickly without undressing. She stiffens when she feels one of her paper curlers coming undone from the activity of love. Imprints in her mind which one it is that's coming loose, so she can quickly secure it once he's through. She hopes he will not sweat. The damp may get into her hair, and that she will remain dry between her legs. She hates the glucking sound they make when she is moist. When she senses some spasm about to grip him, she will make rapid movements with her hips, press her fingernails into his back, suck in her breath, and pretend she's having an orgasm. She might wonder again, for the 600th time, what it would be like to have that feeling while her husband's penis is inside her. The closest thing to it was the time she was walking down the street and her napkin slipped free of her sanitary belt. It moved gently between her legs as she walked, gently, ever so gently, and then a slight and distinctly delicious sensation collected in her crotch. As the delight grew, she had to stop in the street, hold her thighs together to contain it. That must be what it is like, she thinks, but it never happens while he is inside her. When he withdraws, she pulls her nightgown down, slips out of the bed and into the bathroom with relief. Occasionally, some living thing will engage her affections. A cat, perhaps, who will love her order, precision, and constancy, who will be as clean and quiet as she is. The cat will settle quietly on the windowsill and caress her with his eyes. She can hold him in her arms, letting his back paws struggle for footing on her breast, and his forepaws cling to her shoulder. She can rub the smooth fur and feel the unresisting flesh underneath. At her gentlest touch, he will preen, stretch, and open his mouth, and she will accept the strangely pleasant sensation that comes when he writhes beneath her hand and flattens his eyes with a surfeit of sensual delight. When she stands cooking at the table, he will circle about her shanks, and the trill of his fur spirals up her legs to her thighs to make her fingers tremble a little in the pie dough. Or, as she sits reading the uplifting thoughts in the Liberty magazine, the cat will jump into her lap. She will fondle that soft hill of hair and let the warmth of the animal's body seep over and into the deeply private areas of her lap. Sometimes the magazine drops, and she opens her legs just a little, and the two of them will be still together, perhaps shifting a little together, sleeping a little together, until 4 o'clock, when the intruder comes home from work, vaguely anxious about what's for dinner. The cat will always know that he is first in her affections, even after she bears a child, for she does bear a child, easily and painlessly, but only one, a son named Junior. One such girl from Mobile or Meridian or Aiken, who did not sweat in her armpits nor between her thighs, who smelled of wood and vanilla, who had made souffles in the home economics department, moved with her husband, Louis, to Lorain, Ohio. Her name was Geraldine. There, she built her nest, ironed shirts, potted bleeding hearts, played with her cat, and birthed Louis Jr. Geraldine did not allow her baby, Jr., to cry. As long as his needs were physical, she could meet them, comfort and satiety. He was always brushed, bathed, oiled, and shod. Geraldine did not talk to him, coo to him, or indulge him in kissing bouts, but she saw that every other desire was fulfilled. It was not long before the child discovered the difference in his mother's behavior to himself and the cat. As he grew older, he learned how to direct his hatred of his mother to the cat and spent some happy moments watching it suffer. The cat survived because Geraldine was seldom away from home and could effectively soothe the animal when Junior abused him. Geraldine, Louis, Junior, and the cat lived next to the playground of Washington Irving School. Junior considered the playground his own, and the school children coveted his freedom to sleep late, go home for lunch, and dominate the playground after school. He hated to see the swings, slides, monkey bars, and seesaws empty, and tried to get kids to stick around as long as possible. White kids. His mother did not like him to play with the niggers. She had explained to him the difference between colored people and niggers. They were easily identifiable. Colored people were neat and quiet. Niggers were dirty and loud. He belonged to the former group. He wore white shirts and blue trousers. His hair was cut as close to his scalp as possible, to avoid any suggestion of wool. The part was etched into his hair by the barber. In winter, his mother put Jergens lotion on his face to keep the skin from becoming ashen. Even though he was light-skinned, it was possible to ash. The line between colored and nigger was not always clear. Subtle and telltale signs threatened to erode it, and the watch had to be constant. Junior used to long to play with the black boys. More than anything in the world, he wanted to play King of the Mountain and have them push him down the mound of dirt and roll over him. He wanted to feel their hardness pressing on him, smell their wild blackness, and say fuck you with that lovely casualness. He wanted to sit with them on curbstones and compare the sharpness of jackknives, the distance and arcs of spitting. In the toilet, he wanted to share with them the laurels of being able to pee far and long. Bayboy and PL had at one time been his idols. Gradually, he came to agree with his mother that neither Bayboy nor PL was good enough for him. He played only with Ralph Nesinski, who was 2 years younger, wore glasses, and didn't want to do anything. More and more, Junior enjoyed bullying girls. It was easy making them scream and run. How he laughed when they fell down and their bloomers showed. When they got up, their faces red and crinkled, it made him feel good. The nigger girls he did not pick on very much. They usually traveled in packs, and once when he threw a stone at some of them, they chased, caught, and beat him witless. He lied to his mother, saying Bayboy did it. His mother was very upset. His father just kept on reading the Lorraine Journal. When the mood struck him, he would call a child passing by to come and play on the swings or the seesaw. If the child wouldn't or did and left too soon, Junior threw gravel at him. He became a very good shot. Alternately bored and frightened at home, the playground was his joy. On a day when he had been especially idle, he saw a very black girl taking a shortcut through the playground. She kept her head down as she walked. He had seen her many times before, standing alone, always alone, at recess. Nobody ever played with her. Probably, he thought, because she was ugly. Now Junior called to her. Hey, what are you doing walking through my yard? The girl stopped. Nobody can come through this yard unless I say so. This ain't your yard. It's the school's. But I'm in charge of it. The girl started to walk away. Wait, Junior walked toward her. You can play in it if you want to. What's your name? Piccola. I don't want to play. Come on. I'm not going to bother you. I gotta go home. Say, you want to see something? I got something to show you. No. What is it? Come on in my house. See, I live right here. Come on. I'll show you. Show me what? Some kittens. We got some kittens. You can have one if you want. Real kittens? Yeah. Come on. He pulled gently at her dress. Piccola began to move toward his house. When he knew she had agreed, Junior ran ahead excitedly, stopping only to yell back at her to come on. He held the door open for her, smiling his encouragement. Piccola climbed the porch stairs and hesitated there, afraid to follow him. The house looked dark. Junior said, there's nobody here. My ma's gone out, and my father's at work. Don't you want to see the kittens? Junior turned on the lights. Piccola stepped inside the door. How beautiful, she thought. What a beautiful house. There was a big red and gold Bible on the dining room table. Little lace doilies were everywhere, on arms and backs of chairs, in the center of a large dining table, on little tables. Potted plants were on all the windowsills. A color picture of Jesus Christ hung on a wall with the prettiest paper flowers fastened on the frame. She wanted to see everything slowly, slowly, but Junior kept saying, hey, you, come on, come on. He pulled her into another room, even more beautiful than the first. More doilies, a big lamp with green and gold base and white shade. There was even a rug on the floor, with enormous dark red flowers. She was deep in admiration of the flowers when Junior said, "Here." Piccola turned. "Here is your kitten," he screeched, and he threw a big black cat right in her face. She sucked in her breath in fear and surprise and felt fur in her mouth. The cat clawed her face and chest in an effort to right itself, then leaped nimbly to the floor. Junior was laughing and running around the room, clutching his stomach delightedly. Piccola touched the scratched place on her face and felt tears coming. When she started toward the doorway, Junior leaped in front of her. "You can't get out. You're my prisoner," he said. His eyes were merry, but hard. "You let me go." "No." He pushed her down, ran out the door that separated the rooms, and held it shut with his hands. Piccola's banging on the door increased his gasping, high-pitched laughter. The tears came fast, and she held her face in her hands. When something soft and furry moved around her ankles, she jumped and saw it was the cat. He wound himself in and about her legs. Momentarily distracted from her fear, she squatted down to touch him, her hands wet from the tears. The cat rubbed up against her knee. He was black all over, deep, silky black, and his eyes, pointing down toward his nose, were bluish green. The light made them shine like blue ice. Piccola rubbed the cat's head. He whined, his tongue flicking with pleasure. The blue eyes in the black face held her. Junior, curious at not hearing her sobs, opened the door and saw her squatting down, rubbing the cat's back. He saw the cat stretching its head and flattening its eyes. He had seen that expression many times as the animal responded to his mother's touch. "Give me my cat," his voice broke. With a movement both awkward and sure, he snatched the cat by one of its hind legs and began to swing it around his head in a circle. "Stop that," Piccola was screaming. The cat's free paws were stiffened, ready to grab anything to restore balance, its mouth wide, its eyes blue streaks of horror. Still screaming, Piccola reached for Junior's hand. She heard her dress rip under her arm. Junior tried to push her away, but she grabbed the arm which was swinging the cat. They both fell, and in falling, Junior let go the cat, which, having been released in mid-motion, was thrown full force against the window. It slithered down and fell on the radiator behind the sofa. Except for a few shudders, it was still. There was only the slightest smell of singed fur. Geraldine opened the door. "What is this?" Her voice was mild, as though asking a perfectly reasonable question. "Who is this girl?" "She killed our cat," said Junior. "Look." He pointed to the radiator where the cat lay, its blue eyes closed, leaving only an empty, black, and helpless face. Geraldine went to the radiator and picked up the cat. He was limp in her arms, but she rubbed her face in his fur. She looked at Piccola, saw the dirty, torn dress, the plaits sticking out on her head, hair matted where the plaits had come undone, the muddy shoes with the wad of gum peeping out from between the cheap soles, the soiled socks, one of which had been walked down into the heel of the shoe. She saw the safety pin holding the hem of the dress up. Up over the hump of the cat's back, she looked at her. She'd seen this little girl all of her life, hanging out of windows over saloons in Mobile, crawling over the porches of shotgun houses on the edge of town, sitting in bus stations, holding paper bags, and crying to mothers who kept saying, "Shut up." Hair uncombed, dresses falling apart, shoes untied and caked with dirt. They had stared at her with great, uncomprehending eyes, eyes that questioned nothing and asked everything. Unblinking and unabashed, they stared up at her. The end of the world lay in their eyes, and the beginning and all the waste in between. They were everywhere. They slept six in a bed, all their pee mixing together in the night as they wet their beds, each in his own candy and potato chip dream. In the long, hot days, they idled away, picking plaster from the walls and digging into the earth with sticks. They sat in little rows on street curbs, crowded into pews at church, taking space from the nice, neat, colored children. They clowned on the playgrounds, broke things in dime stores, ran in front of you on the street, made ice slides on the sloped sidewalks in winter. The girls grew up knowing nothing of girdles, and the boys announced their manhood by turning the bills of their caps backward. Grass wouldn't grow where they lived. Flowers died. Shades fell down. Tin cans and tires blossomed where they lived. They lived on cold, black-eyed peas and orange pop. Like flies, they hovered. Like flies, they settled. And this one had settled in her house. Up over the hump of the cat's back, she looked. "Get out," she said, her voice quiet. "You nasty little black bitch. Get out of my house." The cat shuddered and flicked his tail. Piccola backed out of the room, staring at the pretty milk-brown lady in the pretty golden-green house who was talking to her through the cat's fur. The pretty lady's words made the cat fur move. The breath of each word parted the fur. Piccola turned to find the front door and saw Jesus looking down at her with sad and unsurprised eyes, his long brown hair parted in the middle, the gay paper flowers twisted around his face. Outside, the March wind blew into the rip in her dress. She held her head down against the cold, but she could not hold it low enough to avoid seeing the snowflakes falling and dying on the pavement. Spring. The first twigs are thin, green, and supple. They bend into a complete circle but will not break. Their delicate, showy hopefulness, shooting from forsythia and lilac bushes, meant only a change in whipping style. They beat us differently in the spring. Instead of the dull pain of a winter strap, there were these new green switches that lost their sting long after the whipping was over. There was a nervous meanness in these long twigs that made us long for the steady stroke of a strap or the firm but honest slap of a hairbrush. Even now, spring for me is shot through with the remembered ache of switchings, and forsythia holds no cheer. Sunk in the grass of an empty lot on a spring Saturday, I split the stems of milkweed and thought about ants and peach pits and death and where the world went when I closed my eyes. I must have lain long in the grass, for the shadow that was in front of me when I left the house had disappeared when I went back. I entered the house as the house was bursting with an uneasy quiet. Then I heard my mother singing something about trains and Arkansas. She came in the back door with some folded yellow curtains which she piled on the kitchen table. I sat down on the floor to listen to the song's story and noticed how strangely she was behaving. She still had her hat on, and her shoes were dusty, as though she had been walking in deep dirt. She put on some water to boil, and then swept the porch. Then she hauled out the curtain stretcher, but instead of putting the damp curtains on it, she swept the porch again, all the time singing about trains and Arkansas. When she finished, I went to look for Frida. I found her upstairs, lying on our bed, crying the tired, whimpering cry that follows the first wailings, mostly gasps and shudderings. I lay on the bed and looked at the tiny bunches of wild roses sprinkled over her dress. Many washings had faded their color and dimmed their outlines. "What happened, Frida?" She lifted a swollen face from the crook of her arm. Shuddering still, she sat up, letting her thin legs dangle over the bedside. I knelt on the bed and picked up the hem of my dress to wipe her running nose. She never liked wiping noses on clothes, but this time she let me. It was the way Mama did with her apron. "Did you get a whipping?" She shook her head no. "Then why are you crying?" "Because."
"Because what?"
"Mr. Henry."
"What'd he do?"
"Daddy beat him up."
"What for?"
"The Maginot Line."
"Did he find out about the Maginot Line?"
"No."
"Well, what then? Come on, Frida. How come I can't know?"
"He picked at me."
"Picked at you? You mean like Soaphead Church?"
"Sort of."
"He showed his privates at you?"
"No.
He touched me."
"Where?"
"Here and here."
She pointed to the tiny breasts that, like two fallen acorns, scattered a few faded rose leaves on her dress.
"Really? How did it feel?"
"Oh, Claudia."
She sounded put out. I wasn't asking the right questions.
"It didn't feel like anything."
"But wasn't it supposed to feel good, I mean?" Frida sucked her teeth.
"What'd he do, just walk up and pinch them?"
She sighed. "First he said how pretty I was. Then he grabbed my arm and touched me."
"Where was Mama and Daddy?"
"Over at the garden, weeding."
"What'd you say when he did it?"
"Nothing, I just ran out the kitchen and went to the garden.
Mama said we was never to cross the tracks by ourselves."
"Well, what would you do? Set there and let him pinch you?" I looked at my chest. "I don't have nothing to pinch. I'm never going to have nothing."
"Oh, Claudia, you're jealous of everything. You want him to?"
"No, I just get tired of having everything last."
"You do not. What about scarlet fever? You had that first."
"Yes, but it didn't last.
Anyway, what happened at the garden?"
"I told Mama, and she told Daddy, and we all come home, and he was gone, so we waited for him. And when Daddy saw him come up on the porch, he threw our old tricycle at his head and knocked him off the porch."
"Did he die?"
"No. He got up and started singing, 'Nearer, my God, to thee.' Then Mama hit him with a broom and told him to keep the Lord's name out of his mouth. But he wouldn't stop, and Daddy was cussing, and everybody was screaming."
"Oh, shoot, I always miss stuff." "And Mr. Buford came running out with his gun, and Mama told him to go somewhere and sit down. And Daddy said, 'No, give him the gun.' And Mr. Buford did, and Mama screamed, and Mr. Henry shut up and started running. And Daddy shot at him, and Mr. Henry jumped out of his shoes and kept on running in his socks. Then Rosemary came out and said that Daddy was going to jail, and I hit her. Real hard."
"Real hard.
Is that when Mama whipped you?"
"She didn't whip me, I told you."
"Then why are you crying?" Miss Dunyan came in after everybody was quiet, and Mama and Daddy was fussing about who let Mr. Henry in anyway. And she said that Mama should take me to the doctor because I might be ruined. And Mama started screaming all over again. At you? No, at Miss Dunyan. But why were you crying? I don't want to be ruined. What's ruined? You know, like the Maginot Line. She's ruined. Mama said so. The tears came back. An image of Frida, big and fat, came to mind. Her thin legs swollen, her face surrounded by layers of rouged skin. I too began to feel tears. But Frida, you could exercise and not eat. She shrugged. Besides, what about China and Poland? They're ruined too, aren't they? And they ain't fat. That's because they drink whiskey. Mama says whiskey ate them up. You could drink whiskey. Where would I get whiskey? We thought about this. Nobody would sell it to us. We had no money anyway. There was never any in our house. Who would have some? Picola, I said. Her father's always drunk. She can get us some. You think so? Sure. Charlie's always drunk. Let's go ask her. We don't have to tell her what for. Now? Sure now. What'll we tell Mama? Nothing. Let's just go out the back, one at a time, so she won't notice. Okay. You go first, Claudia. We opened the fence gate at the bottom of the backyard and ran down the alley. Picola lived on the other side of Broadway. We had never been in her house, but we knew where it was, a two-story gray building that had been a store downstairs and had an apartment upstairs. Nobody answered our knock on the front door, so we walked around to the side door. As we approached, we heard radio music and looked to see where it came from. Above us was the second-story porch, lined with slanting, rotting rails, and sitting on the porch was the Maginot Line herself. We stared up and automatically reached for the other's hand. A mountain of flesh, she lay rather than sat in a rocking chair. She had no shoes on, and each foot was poked between a railing, tiny baby toes at the tip of puffy feet, swollen ankles smoothed and tightened the skin, massive legs like tree stumps parted wide at the knees, over which spread two rows of soft, flabby inner thigh that kissed each other deep in the shade of her dress and closed. A dark brown root beer bottle, like a burned limb, grew out of her dimpled hand. She looked at us down through the porch railings and emitted a low, long belch. Her eyes were as clean as rain, and again I remembered the waterfall. Neither of us could speak. Both of us imagined we were seeing what was to become of Frida. The Maginot Line smiled at us. You all looking for somebody? I had to pull my tongue from the roof of my mouth to say, Picola, she live here? Uh-huh, but she ain't here now. She gone to her mama's workplace to get the wash. Yes, ma'am, she coming back? Uh-huh, she gotta hang up the clothes before the sun goes down. Oh, you can wait for her. Wanna come up here and wait? We exchanged glances. I looked back up at the broad cinnamon roads that met in the shadow of her dress. Frida said, no, ma'am. Well, the Maginot Line seemed interested in our problem. You can go to her mama's workplace, but it's way over by the lake. Where by the lake? That big white house with the wheelbarrow full of flowers. It was a house that we knew, having admired the large white wheelbarrow tilted down on spoked wheels and planted with seasonal flowers.
Ain't that too far for you all to go walking?
Frida scratched her knee.
Why don't you wait for her? You can come up here. Want some pop?
Those rain-soaked eyes lit up, and her smile was full, not like the pinched and holding-back smile of other grown-ups.
I moved to go up the stairs, but Frida said, "No, ma'am, we ain't allowed."
I was amazed at her courage and frightened of her sassiness. The smile of the Maginot line slipped.
"Ain't allowed?"
"No."
"Ain't allowed to what?"
"Go in your house."
"Is that right?"
The waterfalls were still.
"How come?"
"My mama said so. My mama said you ruined."
The waterfalls began to run again. She put the root beer bottle to her lips and drank it empty. With a graceful movement of the wrist, a gesture so quick and small we never really saw it, only remembered it afterward, she tossed the bottle over the rail at us. It split at our feet, and shards of brown glass dappled our legs before we could jump back. The Maginot line put a fat hand on one of the folds of her stomach and laughed. At first, just a deep humming with her mouth closed, then a larger, warmer sound. Laughter at once beautiful and frightening. She let her head tilt sideways, closed her eyes, and shook her massive trunk, letting the laughter fall like a wash of red leaves all around us. Scraps and curls of the laughter followed us as we ran. Our breath gave out at the same time our legs did. After we rested against a tree, our heads on crossed forearms, I said, "Let's go home." Frida was still angry, fighting, she believed, for her life. "No, we gotta get it now. We can't go all the way to the lake."
"Yes, we can. Come on. Mama gonna get us."
"No, she ain't. Besides, she can't do nothing but whip us."
That was true. She wouldn't kill us or laugh a terrible laugh at us or throw a bottle at us. We walked down tree-lined streets of soft gray houses leaning like tired ladies. The streets changed. Houses looked more sturdy. Their paint was newer. Porch posts straighter. Yards deeper. Then came brick houses set well back from the street, fronted by yards edged in shrubbery, clipped into smooth cones and balls of velvet green. The lakefront houses were the loveliest. Garden furniture, ornaments, windows like shiny eyeglasses, and no sign of life. The backyards of these houses fell away in green slopes, down to a strip of sand. Then the blue Lake Erie, lapping all the way to Canada. The orange-patched sky of the steel mill section never reached this part of town. This sky was always blue. We reached Lakeshore Park, a city park laid out with rosebuds, fountains, bowling greens, picnic tables. It was empty now, but sweetly expectant of clean, white, well-behaved children and parents who would play there above the lake in summer before half-running, half-stumbling down the slope to the welcoming water. Black people were not allowed in the park, and so it filled our dreams. Right before the entrance to the park was the large white house with the wheelbarrow full of flowers. Short crocus blades sheathed the purple and white hearts that so wished to be first they endured the chill and rain of early spring. The walkway was flagged in calculated disorder, hiding the cunning symmetry. Only fear of discovery and the knowledge that we did not belong kept us from loitering. We circled the proud house
and went to the back. There, on the tiny railed stoop, sat Piccola in a light red sweater and blue cotton dress. A little wagon was parked near her. She seemed glad to see us. "Hi. Hi. What you all doing here?" She was smiling, and since it was a rare thing to see on her, I was surprised at the pleasure it gave me. "We're looking for you. Who told you I was here?" "The Maginot Line." "Who is that?" "That big fat lady. She lives over you." "Oh, you mean Miss Marie. Her name is Miss Marie." "Well, everybody calls her Miss Maginot Line. Ain't you scared?" "Scared of what?" "The Maginot Line." Piccola looked genuinely puzzled. "What for? Your mama let you go in her house and eat out of her plates?" "She don't know I go. Miss Marie is nice. They all nice." "Oh, yeah," I said. "She tried to kill us." "Who, Miss Marie? She don't bother nobody." "Then how come your mama don't let you go in her house if she's so nice?" "I don't know. She say she's bad, but they ain't bad. They give me stuff all the time." "What stuff?" "Oh, lots of stuff. Pretty dresses and shoes. I got more shoes than I ever wear. And jewelry and candy and money. They take me to the movies. And once we went to the carnival. China gonna take me to Cleveland to see the square. And Poland gonna take me to Chicago to see the loop. We going everywhere together." "You lying. You don't have no pretty dresses." "I do too." "Oh, come on, Piccola. What you telling us all that junk for?" Frida asked. "It ain't junk." Piccola stood up, ready to defend her words, when the door opened. Mrs. Breedlove stuck her head out the door and said, "What's going on out here? Piccola, who are these children?" "That's Frida and Claudia, Mrs. Breedlove." "Whose girls are you?" She came all the way out on the stoop. She looked nicer than I had ever seen her, in her white uniform and her hair in a small pompadour. "Mrs. McTeer's girls, ma'am." "Oh, yes. Live over on 21st Street?" "Yes, ma'am." "What are you doing way over here?" "Just walking. We came to see Piccola." "Well, you better get on back. You can walk with Piccola. Come on in while I get the wash." We stepped into the kitchen, a large, spacious room. Mrs. Breedlove's skin glowed like taffeta in the reflection of white porcelain, white woodwork, polished cabinets, and brilliant copperware. Odors of meat, vegetables, and something freshly baked mixed with the scent of Fels naphtha. "I'm gonna get the wash. You all stand stock still, right there, and don't mess up nothing." She disappeared behind a white swinging door, and we could hear the uneven flap of her footsteps as she descended into the basement. Another door opened, and in walked a little girl, smaller and younger than all of us. She wore a pink sunback dress and pink, fluffy bedroom slippers with two bunny ears pointed up from the tips. Her hair was corn yellow and bound in a thick ribbon. When she saw us, fear danced across her face for a second. She looked anxiously around the kitchen. "Where's Polly?" she asked. The familiar violence rose in me. Her calling Mrs. Breedlove Polly, when even Piccola called her mother Mrs. Breedlove, seemed reason enough to scratch her. "She's downstairs," I said. "Polly," she called. "Look," Frida whispered, "look at that." On the counter, near the stove, in a silvery pan, was a deep dish berry cobbler, the purple juice bursting here and there through crust. We moved closer. "It's still hot," Frida said. Piccola stretched her hand to touch the pan lightly to see if it was hot. Polly, come here, the little girl called again. It may have been nervousness, awkwardness, but the pan tilted under Piccola's fingers and fell to the floor, splattering blackish blueberries everywhere. Most of the juice splashed on Piccola's legs, and the burn must have been painful, for she cried out and began hopping about, just as Mrs. Breedlove entered with a tightly packed laundry bag. In one gallop, she was on Piccola, and with the back of her hand, knocked her to the floor. Piccola slid in the pie juice, one leg folding under her. Mrs. Breedlove yanked her up by the arm, slapped her again, and in a voice thin with anger, abused Piccola directly, and Frida and me by implication. Crazy fool, my floor mess. Look what you work, get on out. Now that crazy, my floor, my floor, my floor. Her words were hotter and darker than the smoking berries, and we backed away in dread. The little girl in pink started to cry. Mrs. Breedlove turned to her. Hush, baby, hush. Come here. Oh, Lord, look at your dress. Don't cry no more. Polly will change it. She went to the sink and turned tap water on a fresh towel. Over her shoulder, she spit out words to us like rotten pieces of apple. Pick up that wash and get on out of here so I can get this mess cleaned up. Piccola picked up the laundry bag, heavy with wet clothes, and we stepped hurriedly out the door. As Piccola put the laundry bag in the wagon, we could hear Mrs. Breedlove hushing and soothing the tears of the little pink and yellow girl. Who were they, Polly? Don't worry none, baby. You gonna make another pie? Course I will. Who were they, Polly? Hush. Don't worry none, she whispered, and the honey in her words complimented the sundown spilling on the lake. See, Mother, Mother is very nice. Mother, will you play with Jane? Mother laughs. Laugh, Mother. Laugh. Laugh. The easiest thing to do would be to build a case out of her foot. That is what she herself did. But to find out the truth about how dreams die, one should never take the word of the dreamer. The end of her lovely beginning was probably the cavity in one of her front teeth. She preferred, however, to think always of her foot. Although she was the 9th of 11 children and lived on a ridge of red Alabama clay 7 miles from the nearest road, the complete indifference with which a rusty nail was met when it punched clear through her foot during her second year of life saved Pauline Williams from total anonymity. The wound left her with a crooked, archless foot that flopped when she walked, not a limp that would have eventually twisted her spine, but a way of lifting the bad foot as though she were extracting it from little whirlpools that threatened to pull it under. Slight as it was, this deformity explained for her many things that would have been otherwise incomprehensible. Why she alone, of all the children, had no nickname. Why there were no funny jokes and anecdotes about funny things she had done. Why no one ever remarked on her food preferences. No saving of the wing or neck for her. No cooking of the peas in a separate pot without rice because she did not like rice. Why nobody teased her. Why she never felt at home anywhere or that she belonged any place. Her general feeling of separateness and unworthiness she blamed on her foot. Restricted as a child to this cocoon of her family's spinning,
She cultivated quiet and private pleasures. She liked, most of all, to arrange things, to line things up in rows, jars on shelves at canning, peach pits on the step, sticks, stones, leaves, and the members of her family let these arrangements be. When by some accident somebody scattered her rose, they always stopped to retrieve them for her, and she was never angry, for it gave her a chance to rearrange them again. Whatever portable plurality she found, she organized into neat lines according to their size, shape, or gradations of color. Just as she would never align a pine needle with the leaf of a cottonwood tree, she would never put the jars of tomatoes next to the green beans. During all of her 4 years of going to school, she was enchanted by numbers and depressed by words. She missed, without knowing what she missed, paints and crayons. Near the beginning of World War I, the Williamses discovered, from returning neighbors and kin, the possibility of living better in another place, in shifts, lots, batches, mixed in with other families. They migrated in 6 months and 4 journeys to Kentucky, where there were mines and millwork. When all of us left from down home and was waiting down by the depot for the truck, it was nighttime. June bugs were shooting everywhere. They lighted up a tree leaf, and I seen a streak of green every now and then. That was the last time I seen real June bugs. These things up here ain't June bugs. They something else. Folks here call them fireflies. Down home they was different, but I recollect that streak of green. I recollect it well. In Kentucky, they lived in a real town, 10 to 15 houses on a single street, with water piped right into the kitchen. Ada and Fowler Williams found a 5-room frame house for their family. The yard was bounded by a once-white fence against which Pauline's mother planted flowers and within which they kept a few chickens. Some of her brothers joined the army. One sister died, and 2 got married, increasing the living space and giving the entire Kentucky venture a feel of luxury. The relocation was especially comfortable to Pauline, who was old enough to leave school. Mrs. Williams got a job cleaning and cooking for a white minister on the other side of town, and Pauline, now the oldest girl at home, took over the care of the house. She kept the fence in repair, pulling the pointed stakes erect, securing them with bits of wire, collected eggs, swept, cooked, washed, and minded the 2 younger children, a pair of twins called Chicken and Pie, who were still in school. She was not only good at housekeeping, she enjoyed it. After her parents left for work and the other children were at school or in mines, the house was quiet. The stillness and isolation both calmed and energized her. She could arrange and clean without interruption until 2 o'clock, when Chicken and Pie came home. When the war ended and the twins were 10 years old, they too left school to work. Pauline was 15, still keeping house, but with less enthusiasm. Fantasies about men and love and touching were drawing her mind and hands away from her work. Changes in weather began to affect her, as did certain sights and sounds. These feelings translated themselves to her in extreme melancholy. She thought of the death of newborn things, lonely roads, and strangers who appear out of nowhere simply to hold one's hand, woods in which the sun was always setting. In church especially,
did these dreams grow. The songs caressed her, and while she tried to hold her mind on the wages of sin, her body trembled for redemption, salvation, a mysterious rebirth that would simply happen with no effort on her part. In none of her fantasies was she ever aggressive. She was usually idling by the riverbank or gathering berries in a field when someone appeared with gentle and penetrating eyes who, with no exchange of words, understood, and before whose glance her foot straightened and her eyes dropped. The someone had no face, no form, no voice, no odor. He was a simple presence, an all-embracing tenderness with strength and a promise of rest. It did not matter that she had no idea of what to do or say to the presence after the wordless knowing and the soundless touching. Her dreams disintegrated, but the presence would know what to do. She had only to lay her head on his chest, and he would lead her away to the sea, to the city, to the woods, forever. There was a woman named Ivy who seemed to hold in her mouth all of the sounds of Pauline's soul. Standing a little apart from the choir, Ivy sang the dark sweetness that Pauline could not name. She sang the death-defying death that Pauline yearned for. She sang of the stranger who knew. Precious Lord, take my hand. Lead me on. Let me stand. I am tired. I am weak. I am worn. Through the storms, through the night, lead me on to the light. Take my hand. Precious Lord, lead me on. When my way grows drear, precious Lord, linger near. When my life is almost gone, hear my cry, hear my call. Hold my hand, lest I fall. Take my hand, precious Lord, lead me on. Thus it was that when the stranger, the someone, did appear out of nowhere, Pauline was grateful, but not surprised. He came strutting right out of a Kentucky sun on the hottest day of the year. He came big. He came strong. He came with yellow eyes, flaring nostrils, and he came with his own music. Pauline was leaning idly on the fence, her arms resting on the cross rail between the pickets. She had just put down some biscuit dough and was cleaning the flour from under her nails. Behind her, at some distance, she heard whistling, one of these rapid high-note riffs that black boys make up as they go while sweeping, shoveling, or just walking along, a kind of city street music where laughter belies anxiety, and joy is as short and straight as the blade of a pocket knife. She listened carefully to the music and let it pull her lips into a smile. The whistling got louder, and still she did not turn around, for she wanted it to last. While smiling to herself and holding fast to the break in somber thoughts, she felt something tickling her foot. She laughed aloud and turned to see. The whistler was bending down, tickling her broken foot and kissing her leg. She could not stop her laughter, not until he looked up at her and she saw the Kentucky sun drenching the yellow, heavy-lidded eyes of Charlie Breedlove. When I first see Charlie, I want you to know it was like all the bits of color from that time down home when all us children went berry-picking after a funeral, and I put some in the pocket of my Sunday dress, and they mashed up and stained my hips. My whole dress was messed with purple, and it never did wash out. Not the dress, nor me. I could feel that purple deep inside me. And that lemonade Mama used to make when Pap came in out the fields. It'd be cool and yellowish with seeds floating near the bottom. And that streak of green them June bugs made on the trees the night we left from down home. All of them colors was in me, just sitting there. So when Charlie come up and tickled my foot, it was like them berries, that lemonade, them streaks of green the June bugs made all come together. Charlie was thin then, with real light eyes. He used to whistle, and when I heard him, shivers come on my skin. Pauline and Charlie loved each other. He seemed to relish her company, and even to enjoy her country ways and lack of knowledge about city things. He talked with her about her foot, and asked, when they walked through the town or in the fields, if she were tired. Instead of ignoring her infirmity, pretending it was not there, he made it seem like something special and endearing. For the first time, Pauline felt that her bad foot was an asset. And he did touch her, firmly but gently, just as she had dreamed, but minus the gloom of setting suns and lonely riverbanks. She was secure and grateful. He was kind and lively. She had not known there was so much laughter in the world. They agreed to marry and go way up north, where Charlie said steel mills were begging for workers. Young, loving, and full of energy, they came to Lorain, Ohio. Charlie found work in the steel mills right away, and Pauline started keeping house. And then she lost her front tooth, but there must have been a speck. A brown speck easily mistaken for food, but which did not leave, which sat on the enamel for months and grew until it cut into the surface and then to the brown putty underneath, finally eating away to the root, but avoiding the nerves, so its presence was not noticeable or uncomfortable. Then the weakened roots, having grown accustomed to the poison, responded one day to severe pressure, and the tooth fell free, leaving a ragged stump behind. But even before the little brown speck, there must have been the conditions, the setting, that would allow it to exist in the first place. In that young and growing Ohio town, whose side streets even were paved with concrete, which sat on the edge of a calm blue lake, which boasted an affinity with Oberlin, the Underground Railroad station just 13 miles away, this melting pot on the lip of America, facing the cold but receptive Canada, what could go wrong? Me and Charlie was getting along good then. We come up north, supposed to be more jobs and all. We moved into two rooms up over furniture store, and I set about housekeeping. Charlie was working at the steel plant, and everything was looking good. I don't know what all happened. Everything changed. It was hard to get to know folks up here, and I missed my people. I weren't used to so much white folks. The ones I seed before were something hateful, but they didn't come around too much. I mean, we didn't have too much truck with them. Just now and then in the fields or at the commissary. But they weren't all over us. Up north, they was everywhere, next door, downstairs, all over the streets, and colored folks few and far between. Northern colored folk was different, too. Dicty-like. No better than whites for meanness. They could make you feel just as no count, except I didn't expect it from them. That was the lonesomest time of my life. I remember looking out them front windows, just waiting for Charlie to come home at 3 o'clock. I didn't even have a cat to talk to.